Okay, so to get you thinking, I'm going to tell you a story. And it's a true story. This is a true story. There's this girlfriend and boyfriend. And they're having a terrible fight. Oh my goodness. They are fighting. And it's going on and on. It's a terrible weekend. Fighting, fighting, fighting. They live in a small village in a rural area. And so everyone can hear the screaming and the shouting. That's a very poor area. And little shacks. Everyone knows, you know. There's been a little bit of pushing and shoving. And it's not pretty. Early on Monday morning, the neighbors wake up and they go to the bus stop where they line up to catch the bus to go into the city to work. And while they're at the bus stop, they can still hear screaming and shouting. And it's coming from the sugarcane fields. So you can't see anything, but they can hear. They're still fighting. The bus comes. Everyone gets on the bus. Off they go to work. Later that morning, towards lunchtime, a young girl is found dead in the sugarcane fields. Her whole head, she's young, in her early 20s. Her whole head has been bludgeoned with a rock. It's ugly. It's horrific. And the boyfriend goes missing for 3 days. He gets arrested in a township near the city. He's living with his relatives. And so he's charged with murder. And I get the case as the defense attorney. And so what I do is I go to prison to interview my client. But before you do that, what you do is you study the state's case. So I read the witness reports. I study the photographs. Horrific, ugly stuff. I study the post-mortem report. And I go to see my client in jail, in the little interview booth. And so I'm not going to give you his real name, but I'll make one up. So I'm talking to him, Mr. Dlamini. And so I'm talking to him, and I say to him, you are charged with a very serious offense, murder. And this is what, and I explain, you've got to be crystal clear, and I explain to him what it's all about, you know, and the nature of the case. So crystal clear. This is what you're facing. And this ain't no joke. He's a young man. He's utterly terrified. And if you get convicted of this, buddy, well, you know, you're going to be using a government toothbrush for a long time. You know, you know, this is heavy. So I tell him the case against him. Now, got my pen or my paper. What do you want to tell me? What do you say? Let's hear your story. And he tells me, yes, I did it. I did it. And I say, clarification, what did you do? Tell me. He says, I was fighting with my girlfriend and we're fighting and I ended up beating her with a rock. So what do I do as a lawyer? Well, the ethics, there's very clear ethical codes. So I say to him, well then, I advise you to plead guilty. You did it. Plead guilty. Guilty, and I'll help you with mitigation and no. No, I don't want to plead guilty, he says. I don't want to stay in prison. He's a young guy, he's only in his early 20s as well. I don't want to go to jail. In that case, as a lawyer, what do I say? In that case, you have the right to remain silent. And what will happen is the judge will enter a plea of not guilty. That's standard procedure all over the Western world. And then you can just remain silent. The state still has to prove the case against you. Still has to prove it. And let me tell you something. The state's case against you is very weak. Very weak. No one saw you do it. The best witness is dead. That's why defending murder is quite easy, because your best witness is dead. No one even saw you on the day of the murder. No one even saw you. In the docket, there are two witnesses who recognized your voice shouting in the sugarcane fields. But no one saw you. And my job is to test the state's case. That's my job. And so we go to trial a couple of months later, and we go to trial. We're at the trial, and the state leads 5 or 6 witnesses. I've got their statements. I know what they're going to say. State doesn't have to know what you're going to say. You only have to know what they're going to say. And as the witnesses come in, well, look, I'm going to be honest with you. They're uneducated. They're rural people. They've never been in a court before. They're honest people. Honest. Just simple folk. And I start to cross-examine them. What a piece of cake. Easy. Because what do? So the first witness, Mr. Dlamini killed the deceased. Got a long story. And so all I have to do in cross-examination is, did you see him kill? No. But then how do you, I heard his voice. Oh, you heard his voice. Did you hear it clearly? Yes, yes. Okay, then, what did he say? Ah, he can't remember. It's months ago. But he said, you know, I don't think he's lying. That's cool. You sure that's what he said? Yep, you write it down. Next witness. Oh, no, I heard this. Did you hear his? Yes, I heard it clearly. What did he say? Oh, he said that. Totally different. Of course. Because he's a real, they can't remember. And the police are not lawyers. They haven't thought to write it down and blah, blah. Well, after 20 minutes, you have got the witnesses absolutely contradicting each other. And so the judge knows my client is guilty. I know he's guilty. The whole village knows he's guilty. The whole world knows he's guilty. But at the end of the state's case, I stand up and ask, I won't bore you, it's called a Rule 147 discharge, and I ask, can my client be acquitted? There's no case to answer. And the judge can't do anything other than acquit him. There's no evidence against him. And he walks out scot-free. Totally free. And that's the end of that. Do you think that's fair? Does anyone here think that's fair? Well, let me ask you a different question. Should my client be held accountable? There is a young girl with her head, oh, look, I'm not going to get all, it's ugly. Should he be held accountable for that? What do you think? Why? Why? Let's say he gets held accountable. Let's say he goes to jail. Will that bring her back from the dead? Will it change anything? Oh, well, you see, Dwayne. Oh, well, it's not about that. You know, it's really about rehabilitation. That's what prison's about. You know, long ago we used to think prison's about punishment, but we're too advanced for that now. Prison's about rehabilitation. Well, what's the point of that? My client was a young man. He was terrified by this whole thing. I guarantee you 100% he'll never kill again. So what's the point of rehabilitation then? Should he be held accountable? And wait a minute, if you're sitting there thinking, no, he should be held accountable, then I want to ask you a serious question. Don't you think everyone should be held accountable for what they do? Or do you think that some people should be absolutely unaccountable? Do you know anybody who you think should be unaccountable, not answerable to anybody? Whether it's from little things, you know this is going to come up in every sermon. I took my dog for a walk in the park in Joondalup. And you know what someone did last weekend? Some hoon did burnouts on the cricket pitch. So there's these huge circle burnouts on the cricket pitch. Do you think he should be held accountable? I'm being so prejudiced saying it's a he. It's obviously a girl. Do you think she should be held accountable for that? Do you? And that's a little thing. What about someone who murders, like Pol Pot? You know what Pol Pot did? He genocided. More women were raped under Pol Pot than in the history of humanity. Mass rape, mass murder. He died in a 5-star hotel of old age in peace. Do you think he should be held accountable? Do you think so? Well, boy, have I got good news for you. If you're sitting here this morning and you think people should be held accountable, you're going to love the Bible. Because the Bible's got great news. Look at what it says in verse 19. Verse 19, now we know that whatever the law says, it speaks to those who are under the law, so that every mouth may be stopped and the whole world may be held accountable to God. Every single human being, from the little things like burnouts on the field to genocide, will be held accountable to God. And you knew it. Why did you think so? Here's why. Because deep within you, you are made in the image of God, who is just. You're a human being. You know deep within you that people must be held accountable. Do you know why? Because you're not an animal. Do not believe Western secular Australian culture, which tells you that you're an animal. You're not an animal. Don't believe them. You're a human being. And therefore, in the image of God, you know about accountability. It resonates within you. You know this is true because animals are not accountable. Have you thought about the lion recently? Do you know what the lion does? I don't know if you're going to believe me. Do you know that the lion preys on pregnant women? Obviously, when an antelope's pregnant, it's heavy, can't run. The girls can't run as fast as the guys. And so the lion catches pregnant women. He looks for them because they're slower. And he rips them to pieces. And they're never held accountable. You know, people, animals, ain't the same thing. Never mind what they tell you. Everyone is accountable to God. It's a universal idea. The world knows it. Religion knows it. And Christianity knows it. We all agree. But there's a radical difference. Let me show it to you. The world thinks everyone is accountable. If they catch that guy did those burnouts, the world will prosecute him. The world knows everyone is accountable. But here's what the world thinks. Most people will be acquitted, except for Hitler. Hitler's the bad guy. And if you're not like Hitler, God will acquit you. Everyone's accountable, but almost everyone gets acquitted except for Hitler. Religion is a little bit narrower. Religion says everyone's accountable, but a lot of people get acquitted. Good people, people who perform well, who do good deeds, help grannies across the road. Christianity is radically different. Biblical Christianity says everyone's accountable, so we agree with the world, we agree with religion, everyone's accountable, but here's where Christianity is different. Christianity says no one will be acquitted. No, not one. No one will be acquitted. Look at our passage in verse 10. As it is written, this is what the Bible says, none is righteous. No, not one. No one understands. No one seeks for God. No one will be acquitted. Nobody. Now, everybody, if you've been coming to this church for a while, for 5 weeks, to be honest, exact and precise, you will know that we're working through the book of Romans, and we've been following an argument. Our passage today is the conclusion to the argument. And so what I'm going to do for you today, like I said I would do last week, a bit different today, is I'm going to summarize the whole argument for you so that you understand where we have landed. You got it? So let me show it to you, and it'll be in your growth groups as well this week. You can explore more. So I've got a table here for you. Watch it closely. Here we go. Number one. From Romans chapter 1, verse 18, Paul has shown three types of people and why no one will be acquitted. Not you, not me. Let me show it to you. First of all, he begins with the pagan party animal. I think we should call her Pink. Okay, Pink, the pagan party animal. He begins with that person, right? And here's what he says about the pagan party animal. Look what she does. Back in Romans 1, 28. Forgive me if there's lots of verses, because we've worked through this. I'm summarizing for you. Here's what God has done. God gave them up to a debased mind to do what ought not to be done. Because they're so party, 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 which is fun for 3 minutes and horrible for 5 hours, but nevertheless, because they party, party, God has said, fine, fine. Go your own way. Go find your own joy. And the result is their conscience is so debased, they literally don't know what's right and what's wrong. They haven't got a clue. They've got a debased mind. And so they're filled, look what it says, with all manner of unrighteousness, evil, covetousness, malice. They're full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, maliciousness. They are gossips and slanderers and haters of, just follow your news feed. You'll see what I'm talking about. Insolent, haughty, boastful, inventors of evil, disobedient to parents, foolish, faithless, heartless, and ruthless. Now, here's the thing. But God never gives up. And so he talks to them. And this is how he talks to the pagan party animal, because they don't read the Bible, right? So how does God talk to them? Here's how he talks to them. God speaks to Pink through creation. That's what he does. What he says is, I'm here and I'm powerful. He constantly talks to the pagan party animal through creation. Look at what Paul says. For what can be known about God is plain to them because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made. So they're without excuse. What Paul showed us is that God speaks to the pagan party animal through creation. Every time she has a baby, okay, so that sounds like a lot. The first time she has a baby, she looks at that little thing, and there's something in her that says, this matters. This is not just biology. She knows. Or she goes to Perth, to get rid of the hangover or whatever. And she watches the sunset. It's amazing. And she thinks to herself, oh my God, why did you say that? What moved in you? Creation shouts at the pagan party animal, even though they don't go to church and they don't read the Bible, that God is there and that he's powerful. But what does she do with that speech? As God speaks through creation, what does she do with it? Here's what she does. She suppresses the truth and therefore dishonors God. She forces it down. Oh, I don't want to think about that. I don't want to think about that. She suppresses the truth and dishonors God. Look at what Paul told us. For although they knew God, they didn't honor him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking and their foolish hearts were darkened. Of course, they think they're wise. Claiming to be wise, they actually become fools. And the great exchange, which we looked at, they exchange the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man, birds, animals, and even worms. Anything but God. I'll take worms ahead of God. Anything but God, the glorious God. So there you got, and Paul took us through that journey. They've got no excuse. They dishonor God, the pagan party animal. But then what Paul does, as we follow the argument, is he talks about a different kind of person. The self-righteous moral person. This is the person who doesn't do burnouts on the lawn. Yeah, he's a good person. This is the person you want to live next door to. Lovely, so sweet. This is a good person. Look how Paul describes her in Romans. No, this will be a hymn. No bias. Okay. Therefore, you have no excuse, O man, every one of you who judges. That's what a moral person does. A moral person goes, that's wrong. that's wrong. You won't catch me doing burnouts. Oh, no. Oh, no, you shouldn't do that. That's wrong. See? That's a moral person. For in passing judgment on another, you condemn yourself because you, the judge, practice the very same things. We know. Look at the moral person. We know that the judgment of God rightly falls on those who practice such things. The moral person says, yep, you deserve it. You are bad. God's going to get you. See, that's how a moral person thinks. But God still speaks to the moral person. Even if they don't come to church, even if they don't read their Bibles, God speaks to them. And he speaks to him through conscience. That's what Paul taught us. We looked at this. God speaks to the moral person through conscience. Have a look at this verse. For when Gentiles, see, he doesn't have the Bible, who do not have the law, by nature do what the law requires. They're a law to themselves, even though they don't have the law. This is your friend next door. He's never read the Bible. Good person, lovely person. They show that the work of the law is written on their hearts, while their conscience bears witness, and their conflicting thoughts accuse or even excuse them. So a moral person has a conscience, and the conscience says, well, you've never killed anyone. On ya, mate. You're excused. You're not a murderer. But at the same time, that same conscience also says, you shouldn't have lied. You shouldn't have told that lie. The moral person, God speaks to them through their conscience. And here's the question. What do they do with that? What do they do with it? Here's what they do. They excuse themselves by judging others and therefore dishonor God. What does the moral person do? They look at other people and go, well, I'm not that bad, so I'm going to heaven. How many times have I said to you, thank goodness for Hitler? Because Hitler makes us all feel better about ourselves. I mean, no one here killed 6 million Jews, have you? So you're okay, you're going to heaven. Well, that's what a moral person does. I just have to look around, find somebody worse than me so I can feel better about myself. That's what a moral person, they judge others in order to excuse themselves. And therefore, they dishonor God. Look at what it says. Do you suppose, O man, now he's talking to the moral person, you who judge those who practice such things and yet do them yourself, that you will escape the judgment of God? Or do you presume on the riches of his kindness and forbearance and patience, not knowing that God's kindness is meant to lead you to repent? You know, because I'm such a good person, God gave me a house in Hillary's. No! The reason nothing's happened to you and you've got all these blessings is God is waiting for you to change. It's his patience that should lead you to change or repentance. All right, the pagan party animal, God speaks to her through creation. She suppresses the truth, dishonors God. The self-righteous moral person, God speaks to him through his conscience. He excuses himself by judging others, dishonors God. At last, we come to the Jewish person. This is what, if you're sitting here and you're going, where are we? What are we doing? I'm summarizing the last 5 weeks at this church. This is what we've been seeing. I'm putting it all together for you. At last, Paul comes to the Jewish person. Look at what he says. But if you call yourself a Jew, and Paul is a Jew, and rely on the law and boast in God and know his will and approve what is excellent. My goodness, you've got so much. Because you're instructed from the law, and if you are so sure that you yourself are a guide to the blind and a light to those who are in darkness, an instructor of the foolish, a teacher of children. My goodness, you're amazing. Having in the law the embodiment of knowledge and truth, Paul's saying you're a Jew, you've got a lot. You have, well, have a look at it. What does God give them? How does God speak to the Jewish person? God speaks to him through written words of the law. The Jewish person had the words of God. What a massive advantage. God speaks to them through the written. Other races didn't have that. They had that. Look at what Paul says. So what's the advantage of being Jewish? What's the value of circumcision? Much in every way. Why? To begin with, the Jews were entrusted with the oracles of God. There was one nation, one race that had a little box called the Ark. And in that box were God's own words. No other race had that. It was amazing. God spoke to them through the written word. Here's the question. And what did they do with it? Tragically, they presumed on the knowledge of the truth and their identity. I'm Jewish, so God must accept me. And therefore, they dishonored God. That's what Paul has told us. Look at what he says. You then who teach others, do you not teach yourself? While you preach against stealing, do you steal? You say that one mustn't commit adultery, do you commit adultery? You who abhor idols, do you rob temples? You who boast in the law, there's that word, look closely at that word, dishonor God by breaking the law. The Jewish person dishonors God. So look what Paul says. Look closely. Can you see that there is no difference at all? Look, I put a circle there, which this morning I discovered was actually a line. Half the circle disappeared, but look closely there. The pagan party animal. God speaks to her through creation. She suppresses the truth and dishonors God. The moral good person. God speaks to him through his conscience. He excuses himself by judging others and therefore dishonors God. The Jewish person, God speaks to him through written words carried in a box, the law. He presumes on the knowledge of truth and identity and therefore dishonors God. Now, people, there are three types of people in the world. And every one of us falls. You can change those names. If you don't like Pink and Matt the moral person and, you know, Levi the Jewish, let's change them. You can call them irreligious person, religious person, Jewish person. Or you could call them relativist, moralist, Jewish person. Or you could call them liberal person, conservative person. It doesn't matter how you cut it. Every single one of them dishonor God. Look at verse 9. What then? Are we Jews any better off? No, not at all. We have already charged that all, both Jews and non-Jews, that is Greeks, are under sin. Okay, Dwayne. You know, I've been coming for 5 weeks. It hasn't been happy, I've got to be honest. But you got me. Okay, you got me. We're all sinners. Okay, why don't you just say that in the beginning? Everyone's guilty. But seriously, Dwayne, what's so bad? I feel like God is a bit harsh. If everyone sins, like really, is sin so bad? Is it really? The key is to look there again. Sin is dishonoring God. God is not like you and me. You and me are not that big. Let's just be honest. We're not that big. So when we make rules and people break those rules, it ain't a big deal. Don't take it personally. Imagine you going down the road and there's a police van parked next to the road. And you walk past it and there's a policeman in the van. Oh my goodness. And he is beside, he is weeping and sobbing and he's got wet wipes and he's in tears. You're like, dude. Are you okay? What's wrong? He said, I saw somebody speeding. Why are you taking it so personally? It's just a rule. Now, the more glorious, the more honorable someone is, the worse it is to disobey them. When your friend says, mate, sit here, and you go, no, I don't want to. That's okay. When your mum says, sit down, imagine you by the Queen, and the Queen says, do take a seat, you know, Would you then say to the queen, I'm not listening to you, don't you tell me what to do? Can you see you've got, the more honorable a person is, the worse it is to disobey them. But it's not just honor and glory, it's also about relationship when you know someone. So, your sister comes in and says, hey, tidy your room. What's the answer? Whatever. You know. Your parent comes in and says, tidy your room's different, eh? Imagine you look at your parent and say, no, I'm not going to listen to you. Forget that. I'm going to break rule 46.3, tidy your room. No, it's not about rules. It's about a relationship. Your parent will say to you, I love you. I care for you. I feed you. I've always been there for you. Or if you're like me, you just say, I brought you into this world and I can take you out. You know, but I don't think that's good parenting. Now let's just think about this. Now think with me. Just think with me. Why is sin such a big deal? Here's why. Because God is infinitely more glorious than the queen. Not more, infinitely more glorious than the queen. And God has infinitely got more authority than a parent. And God is the infinitely loving, caring parent. He's the creator of everything. Everything you have comes from God. The breath in your nostrils, that's God. Your heart going boom, boom, that's Jesus. And that's why to sin is so bad. Sin is an infinite catastrophe, no matter how big, no matter how small, because it's not about the sin. It's about the one you are sinning against. Sin dishonors the infinite honor of God. God takes sin personally. Do you know why? Because he is holiness personified. Sin is anti-God. No. Sin is un-God. And the bigger and the more glorious God is, the worse sin is. That's why liberals have got such a small God. They don't think sin's a big deal. That's because their God is yay big. The bigger your God. What Paul does in this passage is he shows us the practical ways in which we dishonor God. Look quickly with me. Look at verse 10. None is righteous. No, not one. No one understands. No one seeks for God. All have turned aside. Together they've become worthless. No one does good, not even one. The first way we dishonor God, is by turning away from him. We turn our backs on him. When a policeman talks to you, do you just turn your back on and walk away? You're dishonoring, but he's just a copper. How much more when we turn our backs on God? We dishonor him by turning our backs on him. Well, it's almost as if we look at God and go, you're of little value to me. There's a waste paper basket. And it's called irrelevant. And we take God and we drop him in the irrelevant basket. This will help you understand your neighbor. Do you know your neighbor, the 90-year-old egg birther? You look at 90-year-old egg birther next door and you think to yourself, how can she be accountable to God? I mean, really? She's never done burnouts. I mean, she's such a sweetheart. She keeps bringing me muffins. And in fact, one day I saw her feeding stray cats. And she dropped a bowl on her foot. Do you know what she said? She said, bother. She is so pure. My goodness, she's pure. Here's the question. Does she honor God? Not at all. Oh, she's turned her back on him her whole life, 90 years. She thinks cats are more valuable, more worthy of her time than the Creator God. You look at her and you think she's okay. Can you see how she has dishonored God? Besides, everyone knows cats are evil, but that's another. It's not just with our lives, it's with our tongues. What we say, we dishonor God. Look at verse 13. Their throat is an open grave. They use their tongues to deceive. The venom of asps is under their lips. Their mouth is full of curses and bitterness. He's talking about what you say. We dishonor God with what we say. Why is lying so bad? Why is lying so bad? Is it because we're breaking the 22nd rule of civility? Lying is dishonoring to God because He is truth personified. Why do we lie? Why do we lie? Well, different folks lie for different reasons. Some people lie because they're scared of other people. You are dishonoring God because you're more scared of people than the Creator God. You're more concerned about what they think than what God thinks. Some people lie for different reasons. They lie because, I don't know, they're trying to make money. You dishonor God because you value money more than Him. Some people lie for reputation. They don't want to admit what they've done because they're... You more value what people think of you than what God thinks of you. You dishonor God. And finally, we dishonor God by the way we treat others. Look at verse 15. Their feet are swift to shed blood, and in their paths are ruin and misery. And the way of peace they have not known. What's so bad about being ugly to other people? What's so bad about being ugly to other people? The answer is, you're dishonoring God. Look at verse 18. There's no fear of God before their eyes. So when you're judgmental, what's so bad about being judgmental? Yeah, you dishonor God because God is the judge, not you. What's so bad about revenge? I mean, she deserves it. If you knew what she did to me, right? What's so dishonoring to God about revenge? Easy. God says, vengeance is mine. I will repay, says the Lord. What's so dishonoring to God about not loving other people? Why is that a sin? You dishonor God because God is love. And so the conclusion at the end of 5 weeks of studying this section of the Bible is verse 19. Now we know that whatever the law says, it speaks to those who are under the law, so that every mouth may be stopped and the whole world may be held accountable to God. Look at that sentence. Every mouth stopped. A day of silence is coming. The world is so noisy. Oh, I don't believe in God. I think the Bible's full of contradictions. Oh, God should explain this to me. Why did God do that? That's such a dumb thing. I don't do YouTube, TikTok, you know, whatever. God, this, whatever, you know, blah, blah, blah. On that day, dead silence. Say everyone accountable to Him. Everyone accountable to Him. Everyone now, very brave keyboard warriors, on that day, accountable. Okay, Dwayne, you got me. I'm guilty. I'm going to go out there and I'm going to try harder. Oh, yes. I'm going to fix this. I'm going to make it up to God. Is there an old lady I can help across the street somewhere? Look at verse 20. You can't fix it. Verse 20. For by the works of the law, no human being will be justified in his sight, since through the law comes knowledge of sin. Nobody can make it up to God. Nobody. What are we going to do? How will you escape? How will you escape? I am not talking about Auntie Bertha, who you wish was here this morning to hear this. What about you? How are you going to escape? How will you be justified? It tells you there's nothing you can do. Surely the only answer, the only logical answer, the only reasonable answer is we must find a righteousness from somewhere else. We must get a righteousness from somebody else. Because we can't do it ourselves. The quest of every single human being ought to be, where can I find toilet paper? Oh, wait. No, that's wrong. Can you believe it? As the coronavirus approaches, Australia goes into meltdown. And we run around in a mad panic making preparations. I mean, why don't you just shower? But anyway, no, we need, okay. And so as silly as that is, you watch them. I saw a punch up between two adult women. They're running around because, oh, the coronavirus is coming. You know, and not a single Australian stops and realizes Judgment Day is coming. And let me tell you what Jesus said about the coronavirus. Don't worry about it. Jesus said, Matthew 10, don't fear those who can kill your body. Don't worry about the coronavirus. It can only kill you. So, you're going to die anyway. Jesus says, fear him who after you die can throw you into hell. And so your whole life should be not where is the toilet paper, where can I get righteousness? Colds? Where can I get it? And the answer is only one place. Only one place. It's not at this church. It's in a man called Jesus. Jesus can give you the very thing you need. We're going to study this passage next week, but I can't help but giving you a little taster. But now, oh my God, that's such good. Something has happened. But now, that's straight after these verses. The righteousness of God has been revealed or manifested. Apart from the Old Testament, the law and the prophets bear witness to it, right? Look at this. Here's what you're after. The righteousness of God through faith in Jesus Christ for all who believe. That's exactly what I need. Can you see it? What the gospel does, what Jesus does is he says, I've got a righteousness for you. It's like heaven is just tons and tons of toilet paper for free. Jesus is saying, I've got what you need. Where did Jesus get his righteousness from? He earned it. No one is righteous. No, not one. There was one. Jesus. He lived a perfect life. He stored up an infinite store of righteousness. God looked at him and said, you're perfect. This is my beloved son in whom I'm so pleased. And Jesus says, I'll give that to you if you want. On the cross, he swapped places with you. He took your judgment for you. Every Christian here has been judged. Every Christian here has been found guilty. Every Christian, yeah, has been punished in Jesus. And so he stands here saying, I'll give you my righteousness. Oh, will he really, Dwayne? Do I have to arm wrestle him? No, he gives it freely. He literally is dying to give it to you. How much is it? Will I have to tithe? No, it's free. You just have to ask. That is the glory of Christianity. Next week, we're going to study that amazing passage.